how important this was to me. There is research that shows that one way to minimize disappointment is to lower our expectations. True, optimism can sometimes lead to increased disappointment. And I believe these findings are accurate. But there's a middle path, a way to maintain expectations and stay optimistic that requires more courage and vulnerability. Examine and express our expectations. There are too many people in the world today who decide to live disappointed rather than risk feeling disappointment. This can take the shape of numbing, foreboding joy, being cynical or critical, or just never really fully engaging. Sometimes when I'm in one of those moods where I just want to pull the covers over my head and stay in bed, and trust me, there were many of those days during quarantine, I promise myself that I'm going to get less excited about things so I feel less disappointed. Then I always remember this interview I did with a man early on in my research. He was in his 60s, and I will never forget how he looked at me when he said, "I used to think the best way to go through life was to expect the worst. That way, if it happened, you were prepared. And if it didn't happen, you were pleasantly surprised. Then I was in a car accident with my wife and she was killed. Needless to say, expecting the worst didn't prepare me at all. And worse, I still grieve for all of those wonderful moments we shared and that I didn't fully enjoy. My commitment to her is to fully enjoy every moment now. I just wish she was here now that I know how to do that." I don't like the vulnerability of leaning into good things or the uncomfortable experience of examining and expressing my expectations, but I consider it more about discomfort than pain, which is what I heard in this man's voice. I've heard people say that disappointment is like a paper cut, painful but not long-lasting. I do believe we can heal disappointment, but it's important not to underestimate the damage it inflicts on our spirit. When I was researching Daring Greatly, I watched the magnificent Japanese animated film Spirited Away, written and directed by Hayao Miyazaki. There's a scene in the film where a young boy named Haku has taken the form of a dragon, and he's being attacked by a relentless swarm of birds. The attackers are actually origami birds, and they cut Haku, leaving him battered and bloodied. Disappointment may be like paper cuts, but if those cuts are deep enough, or if we accumulate them over a lifetime, they can leave us seriously wounded. Yes, it takes courage to reality check, communicate, and dig into the intentions behind our expectations. But that exercise in vulnerability helps us maintain meaningful connection with ourselves and others. All right, let's take on regret. So both disappointment and regret arise when an outcome was not what we wanted, counted on, or thought would happen. With disappointment, we often believe the outcome was out of our control. But of course, we're learning more about how this is not always the case. With regret, we believe the outcome was caused by our decisions or actions. Interestingly, research shows that in the short term, we tend to regret bad outcomes where we took action. However, when we reflect back over the long term, we more often regret the actions we didn't take, what we didn't do, and we think of those as missed opportunities. As I reference in Rising Strong, I think one of the most powerful lines about regret comes from George Saunders' 2013 commencement address at Syracuse University. Saunders talked about how when he was a young child, a young girl was teased at his school, and although he didn't tease her, and he even defended her a little, he still thought about it. He said, quote, "So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there, in front of me, suffering. And I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly." I want to read this to you again. I think it's one of those quotes that if you had the book in your hand, you'd reread it again So I want to give you and me the opportunity just to hear it again. So again, this is George Saunders. It's from a 2013 commencement address at Syracuse. So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there, in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. So while a meta-analysis, which is just kind of a study of studies, focusing on regret, indicates approximately 90% of regrets fall into one of six categories: education, career, romance, parenting, self-improvement, and leisure. I've heard many research participants echo Saunders in regretting failures of kindness. I know that some of my own biggest regrets include failures of kindness, including failures of self-kindness. While some people disagree with me, I firmly believe that regret is one of our most powerful emotional reminders that reflection, change, and growth are necessary. In our research, regret emerged as a function of empathy. And when used constructively, it's a call to courage and a path towards wisdom. The idea that regret is a fair but tough teacher can really piss people off. No regrets has become synonymous with daring and adventure, but I totally disagree. The idea of no regrets doesn't mean living with courage. It means living without reflection. To live without regret is to believe that we have nothing to learn, no amends to make, and no opportunity to be braver with our lives. One reason we may avoid regret is the fact that it can be accompanied by an element of self-blame and even guilt. Maybe we don't like the accountability that often comes with regret. When I was writing Rising Strong, a friend of mine sent me a picture of this tough-looking kid who had no regrets tattooed across his chest, but it was spelled no, N-O, and then regret was misspelled R-A-G-R-E-T-S. And I later found out that the image was from the film We're the Millers. It's such a perfect metaphor for what I've learned. If you have no regrets, or you intentionally set out to live without regrets, I think you're missing the power of regret and its ability to teach us. In the film, a character played by Jason Sudeikis challenges the guy with a tattoo. It's so funny, this scene. He looks at him and he goes, so, like, reading this misspelled no regrets across his chest, like big letters. And Jason Sudeikis' character goes, so you have no regrets? Not even a single letter? Oh, it was so funny. In our work, we find that what we regret most are our failures of courage, whether it's the courage to be kinder, to show up, to say how we feel, to set boundaries, to be good to ourselves, to say yes to something scary. Regret has taught me that living outside my values is not tenable for me. Regrets about not taking chances have made me braver. Regrets about shaming or blaming people I care about have made me more thoughtful. I think sometimes the most uncomfortable learning is the most powerful. To end chapter 3, we're going to talk briefly about three more emotions and experiences: discouraged, resigned, and frustrated. These are also part of the family of ways that we feel when things are not going or didn't go as desired. Here's a simple way to think about the differences between some of the emotional experiences that I've talked about in this chapter. So disappointed, it didn't work out how I wanted, and I believe the outcome was outside of my control. But if you could see me, I'm winking at you right now, because did we actually examine and set expectations? Is it really outside of our control? Regret, it didn't work out how I wanted, and the outcome was caused by my decisions, actions, or failure to act. Here are the new ones. Discouraged. I'm losing my confidence and enthusiasm about any future effort. I'm losing the motivation and confidence to persist. Resigned. I've lost the motivation and confidence to persist. And then last, frustrated. Something that feels out of my control is preventing me from achieving my desired outcome. So again, we're comparing disappointed, it didn't work out, and I think I didn't have control over it. Regret, it didn't work out, and I think the outcome was caused by me. Discouraged, I'm in the process of losing my confidence and enthusiasm to do something. Resigned is gone. I've lost my confidence, enthusiasm, and frustrated. Something that feels out of my control is preventing me from achieving my desired outcome. So some things to note here. Feeling discouraged and resigned is about effort rather than outcome. With discouragement, we're losing that motivation and confidence to continue, and with resignation, we've lost it. Frustration sometimes overlaps with anger. Both anger and frustration can result when a desired outcome is blocked. The main difference is that with frustration, we don't think we can fix the situation, while with anger, we feel there's something that we can do. Chapter 4, places we go when it's beyond us. Awe, wonder, confusion, curiosity, interest, and surprise. Awe and wonder. And I'm going to start by reading you a quote from Rachel Carson's book, The Sense of Wonder, A Celebration of Nature for Parents and Children. Here's the quote. I just thought it was so beautiful that I had to open this up with it. If I had influence with a good fairy who's supposed to preside over the christening of all children, I should ask that her gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout life as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength. Again, that's Rachel Carson from her book, The Sense of Wonder, A Celebration of Nature for Parents and Children. So both awe and wonder are often experienced in response to nature, art, music, spiritual experiences, or ideas. In the midst of these moments, we can feel overwhelmed by the vastness of something that is almost incomprehensible. It almost feels like we're witnessing something that can't be true, like we're seeing something that doesn't fit with how we move through and understand our everyday lives. Even seeing things we may fail to notice on a regular basis, like a starry sky or a butterfly in the garden, can stop us in our tracks on occasion. Both awe-inspiring events and the experiences that leave us filled with wonder often make us feel small compared to our expansive universe. Small, but connected to each other and to the largeness itself. We often use the words awe and wonder interchangeably, which makes sense because, as you can see, the experiences share a lot in common. But there is a primary difference between our experiences of these incredible emotions that I think is worth understanding. I love how researchers Ulrich Vega and Johannes Vegemann explain it. They write, quote, "Wonder inspires the wish to understand. Awe inspires the wish to let shine, to acknowledge and to unite. When feeling awe, we tend to simply stand back and observe. We want to provide a stage for the phenomenon to shine. Awe and wonder are essential to the human experience. Wonder fuels our passion for exploration and learning, for curiosity and adventure. Researchers have found that awe leads people to cooperate, share resources, and sacrifice for others, and causes them to fully appreciate the value of others and see themselves more accurately, evoking humility. Some researchers even believe that, quote, awe-inducing events may be one of the fastest and most powerful methods of personal change and growth, end quote. And look, we don't have to stand on a cliff and see the northern lights to feel awe or wonder, although, hashtag bucket list, I definitely want to stand on a cliff and see the northern lights. But sometimes I feel like my dog, Lucy, is staring into my soul and I feel a huge sense of wonder. Like, how did I end up with an actual Ewok living in my house? How did it happen? It's unreal. And as a parent, simple moments with my children have rendered me speechless with awe. I thought this would change as they got older, but even with a 16-year-old and a 22-year-old, the awe still takes my breath away on a regular basis. Before we leave awe and wonder, I want to walk you into two illustrations that are in the book. So I knew I was going to have to explain some complex concepts, some of these emotions and experiences in a way that would speak not only to people who could understand it by reading it, but also maybe seeing it. So I reached out to comic artist Gavin Ung Tan, who I've followed his work for a long time. I'm a big fan. He's Australia-based, just does incredible graphic novels and does wonderful drawings around quotes and stories. And I asked, would you be willing to help with this book and some of these concepts? And he said, yes. And that made me the luckiest writer in the world. And so I want to tell you what I'm seeing in the book, and I think I can describe it in a way that you'll get exactly what I mean. So we've got two opposing pages in the book. One is awe and one is wonder. In awe, we have a man looking at a starry sky, and it says, this is how it looks. And it just looks like a guy looking, you just see his face and he's looking at a sky. And then it says how it feels. And you see a tiny body surrounded by a huge starry sky. So how awe feels is we feel small and we're looking at something big and expansive. And then what does awe do to us? It makes us feel connected to ourself, to the universe, and to each other. On the opposing page, we have wonder, and there's a woman who's in her yard and she sees a butterfly. And how it looks is just her looking at a butterfly in her yard. And how it feels is almost picturing herself with these butterflies. And then what it does is rather than just standing there taking it all in and connecting us to the universe and each other like awe does, what wonder does is the last frame of this is she's reading a book called The Complete Guide to Caterpillars and Butterflies. So I think the difference we have to take away is with awe, we just feel small and want to take it in and watch it unfold. It reminds us we're connected to each other and to ourselves. Wonder, it makes us feel small. It's big and expansive, but it drives our curiosity to learn more. All right, let's go from awe to wonder into confusion. I love this quote. I opened the section on confusion with a quote from my friend Adam Grant. His latest book, Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, is one of my favorite books of all time. He has this quote that is, to me, perfect. It says, I need time for my confusion. Confusion can be a cue that there's new territory to be explored or a fresh puzzle to be solved. If I ever start a punk band, which is not out of the question, I've already nailed the name. It's going to be the Zone of Optimal Confusion. It's perfect on so many levels. The concept of optimal confusion is key to understanding why confusion is good for us and why it's categorized as an epistemic emotion. In other words, an emotion critical to knowledge acquisition and learning. It turns out that confusion, like many uncomfortable things in life, is vital for learning. According to research, confusion has the potential to motivate, lead to deep learning, and trigger problem solving. A study led by Sidney DeMello found that when we're trying to work through our confusion, we need to stop and think, engage in careful deliberation, develop a solution, and revise how we approach the next problem. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but how often do we observe people and ourselves dismissing new data or information that challenges our ideas in order to avoid confusion or the risk of being wrong? If you ask me, stopping to think, engaging in careful deliberation, and revising old thinking are rare and courageous actions, and they require dealing with a healthy dose of confusion, and that's uncomfortable. In an article in Fast Company, Mary Slaughter and David Rock with the NeuroLeadership Institute write, quote, to be effective, learning needs to be effortful. That's not to say that anything that makes learning easier is counterproductive or that all unpleasant learning is effective. The key here is desirable difficulty. The same way you feel a muscle burn when it's being strengthened, The brain needs to feel some discomfort when it's learning. Your mind might hurt for a while, but that's a good thing. Close quote. So, you know, my takeaway here is comfortable learning environments rarely lead to deep learning. I'll tell y'all a little aside here. Not in the book, but it's interesting. I used to have a sign in my office at the university that said, "If you're comfortable, I'm not teaching well." And I think that's true. I just think this idea of desirable difficulty is not something we embrace because for some reason, this entitlement to comfort is really dangerous. But I love this idea from all this research that we did that there's a zone of optimal confusion. There's desirable difficulty. That's what makes confusion important. And I have to say that both the zone of optimal confusion and desirable difficulty are great band names. But we have to ask this question. What happens when things get too confusing? Based on DeMello's research, too much confusion can lead to frustration, giving up, disengagement, or even boredom. The learning strategies most often used to help resolve confusion include seeking help, finding the most important information, monitoring progress, and planning a strategy. Let's go next to a section on curiosity and interest. I've done a lot of research on curiosity, starting with Rising Strong, and most recently while working on Dare to Lead. It turns out that curiosity is an irreducible component of courageous leadership. Personally, understanding what it means to be curious and what gets in the way has rearranged how I parent, how I teach, and how I lead. Curiosity and interest are both important parts of our need for meaning-making. But are they the same thing, or are they totally different experiences? The answer? It depends on whom you ask. Researchers absolutely do not agree. There's no consensus. However, in our research, we found a clear distinction between how we use the words curiosity and interest and what they mean to us. Let's start by looking at some examples of how we use the words. We often say things like, "I want my kids to be curious and to show interest." "I'm looking for employees who are curious and demonstrate interest in our work." "I value curiosity in a person," or "they show interest in the topic." What starts to take shape as we look at how we talk about these terms is the difference between thinking and feeling, and between who we are and what we're doing. Here's what emerged from our data. Curiosity seems to be both a trait and a state. Remember that from earlier in the book, where a trait is kind of how we're built and who we are, and a state is how we respond to something? So curiosity seems to be both a trait and a state. You can be a curious person, and regardless of having this trait or not, you can feel curious about something in the moment. Interest is more of a state. Interested is not who we are, but how we are at a specific time. Curiosity seems to involve both feeling and emotion and thinking or cognition, while interest is really about thinking. Curiosity has an emotion to it, where I think interest is really more of a cognitive thinking function alone. So here are the definitions we put together. Interest is a cognitive openness to engaging with a topic or experience. Curiosity is recognizing a gap in our knowledge about something that interests us and becoming emotionally and cognitively invested in closing that gap through exploration and learning. Curiosity often starts with interest and can range from mild curiosity to passionate investigation. In addition to the state and trait differences, the big things to understand here are the heart and head investments. With interest, our mind is open to seeing what's there. But with curiosity, we've acknowledged a gap in what we know or understand, and our heart and head are both invested in closing that gap. There's a thinking challenge and an emotional experience of the satisfaction or potential satisfaction of closing the knowledge gap. In Rising Strong, I talk about George Loewenstein's groundbreaking 1994 article, The Psychology of Curiosity, and his introduction of the, quote, information gap perspective. Loewenstein, a professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University, proposed that curiosity is the feeling of deprivation we experience when we identify and focus on a gap in our knowledge. What's important about this perspective is that it means we have to have some level of knowledge or awareness before we can become curious. We aren't curious about something we're unaware of or know nothing about. I'm going to read that to you again because when I first read it, I was like, that's interesting. The second time I read it, I was like, that's freaking shocking. And so I want to read it to you again. What's important about the knowledge gap perspective is that it means that we have to have some level of knowledge or awareness before we can become curious. We aren't curious about something that we're unaware of or know nothing about. That's big because it has incredible implications for education. Loewenstein explains that simply encouraging people to ask questions doesn't go very far towards stimulating curiosity. He writes, to induce curiosity about a particular topic, it may be necessary to prime the pump, to use intriguing information to get folks interested so they become more curious and to create opportunities for exposure to new ideas and experiences. Curiosity doesn't exist without interest, but we can't be interested and not have our interest grow all the way to curiosity. An increasing number of researchers believe that curiosity and knowledge building grow together. The more we know, the more we want to know. Choosing to be curious is choosing to be vulnerable because it requires us to surrender to uncertainty. We have to ask questions, admit to not knowing, risk being told that we shouldn't be asking, and sometimes make discoveries that lead to discomfort. Our childlike curiosity is often tested as we grow up, and we sometimes learn that too much curiosity, like too much vulnerability, can lead to hurt. As a result, we turn to self-protection, choosing certainty over curiosity, armor over vulnerability, and knowing over learning. But shutting down comes with a price we rarely consider when we're focused on finding our way out of pain. Einstein said, "The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existence." I think that's true. I think curiosity's reason for existing is not simply to be a tool for acquiring knowledge. It reminds us that we're alive. Researchers are finding evidence that curiosity is correlated with creativity, intelligence, improved learning and memory, and problem solving. Let's jump to the next section, which is surprise. I learned a lot about surprise, that it really unlocked some stuff about me that actually surprised me. Similar to findings by researchers Sasha Topolinsky and Fritz Strack, my team and I define surprise as an interruption caused by information that doesn't fit with our current understanding or expectations. It causes us to reevaluate. We can think of surprise as a bridge between cognition and emotion, a bridge between thinking and feeling, but it's a short bridge. Surprise is the shortest duration emotion, rarely lasting more than a few seconds. In addition to being a short bridge, surprise is also an amplifier. Once our thinking brain works out the unexpected thing that's happening, we move into emotion. There's evidence that surprise amplifies subsequent emotion, with more surprising events resulting in stronger emotional reactions. Spoiler, spoiler alert. This is a spoiler alert for a spoiler alert. I'm pretty sure that this research explains why I do not like surprises. I'm not a fan of having to manage amplified emotion while in the spotlight. And it's not just my introversion and the spotlight piece. I don't like surprises in movies or TV series either. I know many of you will find this egregious, but I normally read the entire plot of any potentially stressful movie before I watch it. You can assume that this ruins the movie for me, but it doesn't. I can actually enjoy it better without being thrown off the surprise bridge into amplified emotion. No, thank you. This whole idea that surprise is a short bridge between thinking and emotion and what's on the other end on the emotion side of that bridge is amplified because it started with this cognitive thinking piece of surprise has been just really game changer for me. I do understand why the research shows that surprising news is more likely to be shared, surprising advertisements are more likely to be noticed, and people are more likely to return to a restaurant that was surprisingly better than expected. If I find a restaurant or a product that is surprisingly great, I will talk about it to anyone who will listen. There's a strong relationship between surprise and unexpectedness. In fact, several of the definitions of surprise use the word unexpected. However, in our lived experience, we don't use the word synonymously. We normally use surprise for experiences that link quickly to emotion. When we use the term unexpected, the experience starts with thinking, just like surprise, but it doesn't cross the bridge over into emotion like surprise does. It just stays in cognition. It just stays in thinking. I mean, let's end this chapter with this example. If it's your birthday and we're going to have a surprise party for you and you walk in and the lights flip on and there's 20 of us there and we go, unexpected. It just doesn't work. It just, unexpected doesn't convey emotion the way that surprise does. Chapter 5, places we go when things aren't what they seem. Amusement, bittersweetness, nostalgia, cognitive dissonance, paradox, irony, and sarcasm. So before we jump into any specific emotions or experiences, let's talk a little bit about bigger questions. I mean, this is a chapter on places we go when things aren't quite what they seem. So I want us to grapple with some bigger ideas before we get into specifics. What happens when we feel two competing emotions at the same time? I mean, can two seemingly contradictory thoughts both be true? The answer is yes. Welcome to being human. Competing emotions and contradictory thoughts are messy and can feel uncomfortable, vulnerable, even irritating. But it's important to remember that this push-pull is a reflection of our complexity. And if we're willing to stay with it and stay curious, complexity is one of our greatest teachers. The problem starts when we don't have the skills or experience to tolerate the uncertainty and ambiguity, and we give in to the cravings for neat, mutually exclusive categories. There's nothing more limiting than tapping out of tension and oversimplifying the thoughts and feelings that have the power to help us understand who we are and what we need. Adam Grant has been the top-rated professor at the Wharton School. This is the business school inside of the University of Pennsylvania, and he's been this top-rated professor for 7 years. As an organizational psychologist, he is a leading expert on how we can find motivation and meaning and live more generous and creative lives. Adam is a number one New York Times bestselling writer, and I mentioned earlier when we were talking about confusion that his book, Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, is probably my new favorite out of all of his books. I love talking to, learning from, and debating with Adam. We've been on each other's podcasts, and it's always fun. I think if you're listening to us talk, you can literally hear our brains grinding and bumping into each other over the airwaves. In Think Again, Adam writes about the problem of oversimplifying and the importance of complexity. He writes, as consumers of information, we have a role to play in embracing a more nuanced point of view. When we're reading, listening, or watching, we can learn to recognize complexity as a signal of credibility. We can favor content and sources that present many sides of an issue rather than just one or two. When we come across simplifying headlines, we can fight our tendency to accept binaries by asking what additional perspectives are missing between the extremes. He goes on to say, this applies when we're the ones producing and communicating information too. New research suggests that when journalists acknowledge the uncertainties around facts on complex issues like climate change and immigration, it doesn't undermine their readers' trust. And multiple experiments have shown that when experts express doubt, they actually become more persuasive. When someone knowledgeable admits uncertainty, it surprises people and they end up paying more attention to the substance of the argument. And while Adam is not writing about our emotions, thoughts, and behaviors, this exact same wisdom applies. When we gather information from our emotions, thoughts, and behaviors, especially the layered, messy ones, the tension can serve us. When we're communicating our feelings and thoughts to ourselves and others, we might want to consider sharing our uncertainties. When someone tells me, "You know, I'm not sure how I feel. I'm sad, but weirdly, I'm also relieved." My first thought isn't, "Oh, yikes, they have no idea how they feel," or, "Man, they don't have a lot of self-awareness." My first thought is, "Oh man, I totally get that. I totally get how sad and relieved can coexist. That makes sense." The uncertainty actually feels like self-awareness to me. When someone tells me, "Well, I'm not sure what I think about that policy. I used to be a fierce proponent of it, but I'm learning more and I'm not as sure as I used to be." My first thought isn't, "Oh, what a flip-flopper." My first thought is normally, "Wow, that's rare. What are you learning? I'm curious." Again, it's counterintuitive, but acknowledging uncertainty is a function of grounded confidence, and it actually feels like humility to me. Holding this in mind, that emotions, like life, can be messy and contradictory and complex, let's look at the specific emotions and experiences in this chapter. We're going to start with amusement. The etymology of amusement is interesting. The word dates from the late 1500s when it meant a pleasurable diversion from work or duty. According to researchers, amusement is connected to humor and includes elements of unexpectedness, incongruity, and playfulness. I'm going to read that again because this is important. According to researchers, amusement is connected to humor and includes elements of unexpectedness, incongruity, and playfulness. Amusement is typically seen as a brief spike in a person's level of cheerfulness, lasting only a few seconds. The definition of amusement that aligns with our research is pleasurable, relaxed, excitation. Amusement differs from happiness in that happiness is it's a general sense of pleasure, whereas amusement appeals specifically to one sense of humor. There are two themes that clearly help distinguish amusement from other positive emotions like contentment, gratitude, interest, joy, love, pride. Number one, an awareness of incongruity. There's something unexpected about what causes us to be amused. We weren't expecting that punchline or that behavior or that timing. Number two, when we feel amused, or when we feel amusement, we feel playful with those around us. Is amusement important at work? Research shows that breaks involving amusement may help replenish depleted cognitive resources, and that the replenishment continues through difficult tasks. After reading the research on amusement, I started thinking about how people say, "I did not find that amusing," and why it's sometimes said in this like judgmental voice. I don't have any data to support this supposition, but I wonder if what we're saying is actually that unexpected thing that you did or said that was supposed to be funny was not funny. It's almost like you failed at your attempt to be funny. That was neither playful nor pleasurable. It takes me straight back to my parents reading a note from my teacher and me trying to make a joke about what really happened in the classroom. I can still hear my mom saying, "I am not amused." Let's talk about one of my favorite powerful emotions I think there is, and it's bittersweet. I start this section with a quote from Mark Parent from his book, Believing It All. This quote nails bittersweet. He writes, The bittersweet side of appreciating life's most precious moments is the unbearable awareness that those moments are passing. I'm going to read it to you again, just so I can hear it again myself. The bittersweet side of appreciating life's most precious moments is the unbearable awareness that those moments are passing. Bittersweet is a mixed feeling of happiness and sadness. As someone who feels bittersweet about a lot of things, especially related to Ellen and Charlie, my kids, I was really curious about this emotion. With very few exceptions, developmental milestones leave me feeling bittersweet. I'm proud of Ellen, excited about her new apartment in a different city, and I share Charlie's happiness about his new driver's license. But I'm also sad when I walk by Ellen's room in our house, and I'm sad that I don't get to drive Charlie and his friends to school every morning. As we all know, this is the best time to overhear all the conversations. I asked folks across my social media channels to share some examples of experiences that felt bittersweet for them, and we received more than 40,000 beautiful, heartfelt comments. I don't think I was fully aware of the depth of humanity that lives in the curves of the emotion of bittersweet. Here are some of the most commonly shared experiences and a few notes on context. From social media, here's what we got. Watching children grow up, leaving a job, divorce ending a relationship, graduating, letting go of friendships that aren't working, moving, the death of a loved one, teachers watching students graduate, retiring, coming home from vacation. What all these comments have in common is sadness about letting go of something, mixed with happiness and or gratitude about what's been experienced and or what's next. Several things that are important to keep in mind about feeling bittersweet. It's not the same thing as ambivalence when we're unsure whether we're happy or sad. Bittersweet is feeling both at the same time. One line of research indicates that multiple emotions, such as happiness and sadness, may be rapidly vacillating below our consciousness, but our interpretation may be a more integrated emotional experience. So I think what this research is saying is that under the hood, what we're experiencing is not something called bittersweet, but we're actually rapid firing experiencing sad, happy, sad, happy, sad, happy, sad, happy. But it's happening so fast that it emerges as this kind of third thing of bittersweet. Another thing that I think is important to keep in mind, it's possible that feeling bittersweet, this is according to the research, may be more frequently experienced or recognized by people who have a more nuanced ability to interpret their emotional states. So man, if there was ever a reason for us to get this language and our emotional awareness and literacy app, this would be it. Again, I'll read it to you, that feeling bittersweet may be more frequently experienced or recognized by people who have a more nuanced ability to interpret emotional states. Last, and this is, I think, something really important to keep in mind, developmental research shows that the experience of mixed emotion is not present in very young children, and that it develops gradually. At around age 7 or 8, children report experiencing positive and negative emotions simultaneously. And by age 10 or 11, they can recognize and understand the tension caused by experiencing mixed emotions. Just an aside, Susan Cain has a book on bittersweet that's coming out in 2022, and I just cannot wait. She and I just love talking about this emotion. We actually send each other songs, mostly in French, to be honest, weirdly, that we think evoke bittersweetness in us. So this is such a great, important part of the human experience. The next thing we're going to look at is, I think, interestingly related to bittersweetness, which is nostalgia. I open this section with a quote by Stephanie Kuhns, who's a historian. She writes, "There's nothing wrong with celebrating the good things in our past, but memories, like witnesses, do not always tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We need to cross-examine them, recognizing and accepting the inconsistencies and gaps in those that make us proud and happy, as well as those that cause us pain." The term nostalgia has a really dark past, and I'm not sure there's consensus about the term today. Adrian Matei, a Vancouver-based journalist and editor, has written a brilliant essay on the history and global translation of the word nostalgia. Matei explains, in the late 1600s, Swiss medical student Johannes Hofer noticed a pattern in his patients who were living far from home. Those who were obsessed with returning to their estranged locations became physically, sometimes fatally sick. To reflect this phenomenon, he coined the medical term nostalgia in 1688, which he created by combining the Greek words nostos, homecoming, and algia, pain. The disease's reported symptoms included loss of appetite, fainting, heightened suicide risk, and, according to Swiss doctor Albert von Halle, hallucinations of the people and places you miss. It ran so rampant among Swiss mercenaries fighting far-flung wars that playing Kurien, an old Swiss milking song that seemed to send soldiers into a contagiously nostalgic frenzy, was punishable by death. Matei goes on to explain how cures for nostalgia included being burned with a hot poker, and punishments included being buried alive. As I mentioned, it's a powerful essay, and I encourage you to read it. All you need to do is Google Adrian Matei and the word nostalgia, and it'll come right up. Nostalgia was considered a medical disease and a psychiatric disorder until the early 19th century. Today, researchers describe nostalgia as a frequent, primarily positive, context-specific, bittersweet emotion that combines elements of happiness and sadness with a sense of yearning and loss. The researchers also tell us that feeling nostalgic involves putting ourselves at the center of a story in which we're reminiscing about people we are close to or about important events in our lives. Interestingly, nostalgia is more likely to be triggered by negative moods, like loneliness, and by our struggles to find meaning in our current lives. There is some research that shows that nostalgia can serve us psychologically by increasing positive feelings and helping us, quote, navigate successfully the vicissitudes of daily life. I don't doubt that the bittersweet recalling or romanticizing of our history can relieve pain or help us deal with the hard parts of our life. But the question I have is, at what cost? Across our research, nostalgia emerged as a double-edged sword, a tool for both connection and disconnection. It can be an imaginary refuge from a world we don't understand, and a dog whistle used to resist important growth in families, communities, and their broader culture, and to protect power, including white supremacy. Often what's spoken is, I wish things were the way they used to be in the good old days. What's not spoken is when people knew their places. What's not spoken is when there was no accountability for the way my behavior affects other people. What's not spoken is when we ignored other people's pain if it caused us discomfort. What's not spoken is, I wish things were the way they used to be in the good old days when my authority was absolute and never challenged. So is nostalgia good, helpful, bad, dangerous, detrimental? The answer is yes, which is why we're lucky to have this fascinating research from Sandra Garrido. Garrido presents evidence that nostalgia can be a part of both healthy and unhealthy coping strategies, depending on an individual's personality and coping style. In her study, she found that for individuals who are prone to depression or rumination, nostalgia tends to be associated with negative emotional outcomes. The level of divisiveness, uncertainty, and anxiety in the world today leads a lot of us, myself included, to struggle with rumination, which Garrido explains is, quote, an involuntary focus on negative and pessimistic thoughts. It's important to note that she also differentiates rumination from reflection, which is, as she describes, highly adaptive and psychologically healthy. Rumination is also different from worry. According to researchers, worry is focused on the future, while rumination focuses on the past or on things about ourselves that we're stuck in. Researchers believe that rumination is a strong predictor of depression, makes us more likely to pay attention to negative things, and zaps our motivation to do things that would improve how we feel. This combination of rumination and nostalgia emerged from our research as destructive and disconnecting. If you're wondering how dangerous the combination can be, think back to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, or examine the strategy used by every authoritarian leader in history. Exploit fears by photoshopping a picture of yesteryear to be everything people wanted it to be, but of course never was. Seduce people into believing that a make-believe past could exist again, and then give them someone to blame for ruining the picture or not being able to restore the mythical utopia. Stephanie Coons, the historian whose quote opens this section, explains that it's important to reality check our nostalgic ideas by uncovering and examining the trade-offs and contradictions that are often deeply buried in all of our memories. Were the comfort and safety of that past existence real? If so, were they at someone else's expense? We ultimately define nostalgia from our data as a yearning for the way things used to be in our often idealized and self-protective version of the past. The next thing we're going to talk about is cognitive dissonance. And there's just a really important thread through all the emotions and experiences in this chapter. And I think you'll really get that as we read into this new section. My favorite book on cognitive dissonance is Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me: Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts, by Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. Talk about feeling called out. I learned a ton about how we put a spit shine on almost everything we do and remember. Or, as Aronson wrote in a more recent book, how, quote, human beings engage in all kinds of cognitive gymnastics aimed at justifying their own behavior. The Tavris and Aronson's book dedication reads, "For Leon Festinger, creator of the theory of cognitive dissonance, whose ingenuity inspired this book." Before we jump in, I want to share an abbreviated version of a story about Festinger from their book. When I first read this story, it felt impossible to believe. After surviving the past 5 years in the United States, it now feels sadly plausible. We see these double-down behaviors every day, especially in the anti-science movement. Tavris and Aronson explained that in 1954, the social psychologist Leon Festinger and two associates infiltrated a doomsday cult to find out what would happen when the leader's prophecy failed to be fulfilled. The leader had promised her followers that the world would end on December 21st, 1954, but that they might be picked up by a flying saucer and transported to safety at midnight on December 20th. Tavris and Aronson explained, many of her followers quit their jobs, gave away their houses, and dispersed their savings in anticipation of the end. Who needs money in outer space? Others waited in fear or resignation in their homes. Festinger predicted that, quote, the believers who had not made a strong commitment to the prophecy would quietly lose their faith in the leader when the world didn't end. And, quote, those who had given away their possessions and waited with other believers for the spaceship would actually double down on their belief in her mystical abilities. He predicted that even if the prophecy did not materialize, the followers who lost the most would demonstrate their increased commitment by doing whatever they could to get others to join them. At the time, this hypothesis blew the doors off every existing theory about motivation and human behavior. It was unthinkable. Unthinkable that people would double down once proven wrong. But by 4:45 a.m., when the spaceship was a no-show, their leader shared a new vision of the world. Because of their strong faith, they had been spared. Exactly as hypothesized by Festinger, the most invested members responded by calling the media with the great news, and they became even more invested evangelists for the group. Luckily, the doomsday leader's prediction failed, but Festinger's prediction didn't. And he completely changed the way we think about human behavior. Tavris and Aronson write, "The engine that drives self-justification, the energy that produces the need to justify our actions and decisions, especially the wrong ones, is the unpleasant feeling that Festinger called cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is a state of tension that occurs when a person holds two cognitions, ideas, attitudes, beliefs, opinions, that are psychologically inconsistent with each other, such as smoking is a dumb thing to do because it could kill me, and I smoke 2 packs a day. Dissonance produces mental discomfort that ranges from minor pangs to deep anguish. People don't rest easy until they find a way to reduce it. In this example, the most direct way for a smoker to reduce dissonance is by quitting. But if she has tried to quit and failed, now she must reduce dissonance by convincing herself that smoking isn't really so harmful, that smoking is worth the risk because it helps her relax or prevents her from gaining weight. After all, obesity is a health risk too, and so on. Most smokers manage to reduce dissonance in many such ingenious, if self-deluding, ways. Dissonance is disquieting because to hold two ideas that contradict each other is to flirt with absurdity. And as Albert Camus observed, we are creatures who spend our lives trying to convince ourselves that our existence is not absurd. At the heart of it, Festinger's theory is about how people strive to make sense out of contradictory ideas and lead lives that are, at least in their own minds, consistent and meaningful. The theory inspired more than 3,000 experiments that, taken together, have transformed psychologists' understanding of how the human mind works. I mean, I'm just going to hit a hard pause here for us. If this doesn't help explain the doubling down around politics, vaccinations, I mean, just conspiracy theories, this is so helpful. When we're faced with information that challenges what we believe, our first instinct is to make the discomfort, irritation, and vulnerability go away by resolving the dissonance. We do this by rejecting the new information, decreasing its importance, or avoiding it altogether. The greater the magnitude of dissonance, the greater the pressure to reduce dissonance. In these challenging moments of dissonance, we need to stay curious and resist choosing comfort over courage. It's brave to invite new information to the table, to sit with it and to hear it out. But it's also so rare these days. As Adam Grant writes, intelligence is traditionally viewed as the ability to think and learn. Yet in a turbulent world, there's another set of cognitive skills that might matter more. The ability to rethink and unlearn. Let's jump from cognitive dissonance to paradox, which I'm telling you is not a big leap. This is all about contradicting cognitions and thinking that drives big emotion. So I love this quote by Carl Jung about paradox. The paradox is one of our most valuable spiritual possessions. Only the paradox comes anywhere near to comprehending the fullness of life. While cognitive dissonance pushes us to resolve the tension of conflicting information, paradox challenges us to straddle the tension of two conflicting elements and recognize that they can both be true. From its Greek origins, the term paradox is the joining of two words, para, which means contrary to, and doikein, which means opinion. The Latin term, paradoxum, means seemingly absurd, but really true. A paradox is the appearance of contradiction between two related components. Although light and darkness seem to be opposites, you can't have one without the other. The opposing elements of a paradox are inextricably linked. Even though the elements seem contradictory, they actually complement and inform each other in ways that allow us to discover underlying truths about ourselves and the world. Here's an example of paradox from my work. Vulnerability is the first thing we look for in other people and the last thing we want to show them about ourselves. How can both of those statements be true? If we dig into the tension of that statement, it actually reveals truths about us. We are drawn to authentic and perfect people, but we're scared to let people see who we really are. I want to experience your vulnerability, but I don't want to be vulnerable. Vulnerability is courage in you, but it feels like inadequacy in me. I'm drawn to your vulnerability, but I'm repelled by my own. Embracing the paradox teaches us how to think deeper and with more complexity. It invites us to reality check the validity of statements that seem contradictory. It moves us away from oversimplifying how systems, organizations, and people, how humans work. Paradox is not an emotion. Much like cognitive dissonance, it starts with thinking but brings an emotion as we start to feel the tension and pull of different ideas. In the case of paradox, our brain wants to solve the puzzle. However, paradoxes can't be fully resolved using rationality and logic. We need to allow the seeming contradictions to coexist in order to gain deeper understanding. In this way, paradoxes force us to think in expansive ways and to lean into vulnerability. About 90% of the work I do these days is in organizations working with leaders. The idea of embracing paradox has been fundamental to building organizational cultures for at least two decades now. In Jim Collins and Bill Lazier's book, BE, Beyond Entrepreneurship 2.0, Jim writes, "False dichotomies are undisciplined thought. In the words of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. Builders of greatness are comfortable with paradox. They don't oppress themselves with what we call the tyranny of the or, which pushes people to believe that things must be either A or B, but not both. Instead, they liberate themselves with the genius of the and. Undisciplined thinkers force debates into stark tyranny of the or choices. Disciplined thinkers expand the conversation to create genius of the and solutions." Jim explains that in his research, they found many permutations of this idea of the genius of the and, these dualities. For example, creativity and discipline, innovation and execution, humility and audacity, freedom and responsibility. In line with Jim's argument, a large body of research shows that rejecting paradox can result in conflict and turmoil. Conversely, engaging with the paradox and accepting the competing elements as both valid